Ladies and gentlemen, I just would like to make two announcements about additional. Please, this is going to be very exciting, and I just want to have everyone ready. I have two brief announcements about additional breakfasts tomorrow morning. This is the last opportunity we have to speak to a lot of you in case you might be interested. We are going to have in addition to the scheduled breakfasts, and you all know which ones you might be going to, we're going to have two casual breakfasts for those of you who want to just pick up breakfast and walk into one of the seminar rooms in the Coke Room. Those two new breakfasts that we're adding, you don't have to sign up, anybody who'd like to come. One is going to be the challenges of running a university, and we're going to have the presidents of Duke and Amherst, the former president of William and Mary, and yes, we're also going to have the former president of Harvard.
Yay!
And that's
There's
going to be
Larry in the back waving at us.
And that's going to be in the Booz Allen room, and it's going to be at 7:45 in the morning, and it will go to 8:45 in the morning. We are also adding a casual breakfast tomorrow morning at 7:45 in the Lauder Room in the same seminar building on North Korea. And Jim Steinberg will moderate a discussion with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and with Representative Jane Harman. So you've got quite a number of exciting opportunities in the morning. I wanted you to be aware of that. With that, I'm going to turn things over to Walter Isaacson.
Thank you and welcome. I could spend a lot of time introducing these two people, but it would feel very pretentious if I acted like you knew who I was but didn't know who they were. So I'm not going to waste our time doing that. I'm just going to say one thing. I am probably the only person in this room who has proven on the public stage not to know anything about the television news business, having been at CNN. But the one thing I did suggest at CNN, we brought in Anderson Cooper, Aaron Brown, and others, I said, why don't they get normal people to be anchors? Why do they get these kind of weird, you know, people like that? Why don't they just get, and I said to my friend Andrew Hayward, who's at CBS, why don't you get normal people to anchor? So Andrew Hayward did just that. Bob Schieffer and then Katie Couric, the two most decent, down-to-earth, normal people you'll ever meet. And so we're really glad to have them here, even if Andrew Hayward lost his job. But Katie, do you miss the Today Show?
I clearly miss my hairdresser.
It's the Aspen Air.
I do miss the people, but I have to say I've had a month off, and it's been incredibly restorative to spend some time in a self-imposed news blackout and be with my daughters and let my brain turn to mush or mushier than it already was. And so I miss the people, but I really feel very confident and comfortable that this is the right thing for me to do, that everybody has a shelf life on a lot of different shows, and I think my expiration date had was nearing, and so I feel really positive about things.
Are you going to miss the CBS Evening News?
Well, he's going to still be on it.
I'm not worried about the shelf life on the program. I'm worried about my shelf life. I'm a little further down the road than my friend Jake is here. It's been like an old guy going to fantasy baseball camp. I mean, I never thought this was going to happen. I got a chance to do it. It has been great fun. And it's just been a wonderful adventure for me. And I'm 69 years old. I never in any way envisioned at this stage of my life doing this for a long period of time. So this has been just perfect for me.
And Bob has done. I just have to brag about Bob for a second because he's such a humble person.
Move your microphone up a little bit because the wind is going wild.
Okay,
yeah.
Is that better?
Yeah.
But Bob has done such a magnificent job and has really restored a lot of the luster of the Tiffany Network, I think. And he's brought the ratings up tremendously. He's got a huge fan base, and he is the quintessential. It sounds so unctuous, but he's of me to wax poetic about Bob. I'm having trouble with this, but he has just been, I couldn't be happier to follow in the footsteps of such a gentleman, and I'm really thrilled for his success. I'm not experienced with these things.
Yeah, these are called level air mics.
I know, but they're so big here.
When you move to CBS,
here.
They have them this way. Yeah, none of that wireless stuff like at NBC.
Yeah.
Speaking of how you did it. Oh, we got a techie joining us.
Thank you so much.
Speaking of how you did it, you changed the nature of what an anchor was by just being a normal conversationalist.
Well, you know, when I got this job and when Les Moonves asked me to do it, and he said, this is something about 6 weeks.
Right.
And I just sat down there and started to analyze what we could do. And when I can't figure out what else to do, I always kind of go back to basics. And that's really what we did. I said, we've got to put the news first. We really, we're in a real hole. For whatever reasons. And the first thing we had to do was get our credibility back. And I said on the first broadcast, you have to do that one story and one day at a time. This is not something you can just promise. We're not going to do it that way anymore. You have to show people that you're really serious about it. And so we did. We put the news first. And that is every broadcast that we did. We sat down and said, what is the most important thing that people need to know about? Now that's not exactly rocket science to say it, but we went back to the basics. And the second thing we did, Walter, I said what we've got to do is develop a team.
Right.
We don't have a star now. And so we put the emphasis in. It's like I think life is a metaphor for baseball. I mean, mm-hmm. Everything that I do, it goes back to baseball. But we were like a baseball team in a rebuilding stage, mm-hmm. And so we had to identify the people that we thought you could build a news department around for the next 10 years or so. And so that's what we did. And I think if there's anything that I did that I take the most pride in, it is developing this young core of really bright young people who are going to be the team that's going to be in place now for Katie. And the interesting thing about it is most of them are now women. There are so many women in the journalism pipeline that it stands to reason that your top people in that 30 to 35 age group are going to be women. I don't know what the guys are doing for a living now, but they don't seem to be going into journalism
anymore.
No,
we're running the Aspen Institute. But before we go to Katie, I just want to mention, because he's mentioned it twice on baseball, that Bob, you actually played baseball briefly in the minor leagues in Texas.
No. I played for TCU, and I got that far. And I have one great link to baseball history. I played for TCU, and Dizzy Dean's nephew, who would be Daffy Dean's son, hit me in the eye. He played for SMU. He hit me in the eye and ended my baseball career.
Well, I see him whenever I go to the Nationals game. You're always right there. Right up front at every ball game. Katie, he mentioned the women coming up. I want to jump to this. What signal is this sending to have a woman as the anchor of an evening newscast?
Well, I think obviously it's hugely symbolic, even though it didn't really enter into my decision-making process, although my 10-year-old at my official kitchen cabinet, which gathered around my kitchen table, my two daughters and our nanny and I discussed my career move, and my 10-year-old said, Mom, when I said, what do you all think I should do? Because obviously it affects our family life with our hours, my hours. And Carrie said, you have to go to CBS. And I was so surprised because I've worked on the Today Show, ever since she was born, obviously, and really ever since Ellie was born, because I was 5 months pregnant with Ellie when I started. And I said, that's so surprising. You think I should go to CBS? And she said, that's right, because you'll be the first woman mom to do that job by herself. And I was like, cue Helen Reddy. I was so surprised. I was like, I had no idea that she would feel that strongly about it. So I thought having that endorsement was important. But I think it really was timing that resulted in this opportunity. Tom and Peter and Dan had those jobs for a very long time. And I think that it wasn't so much that the networks weren't open to having a woman. It's just there were no openings. Mm-hmm. So, but I do think, when I took the job on the Today Show, I said to Michael Gartner, I only want to do this if I can have an equal role with Brian Gumbel, because I think sometimes It's nothing that's necessarily written out, but it's a very symbolic thing if a woman is doing serious hard interviews alongside the men and isn't relegated to the cooking or lifestyle segments. And so I said I wanted the hard news split 50-50. And he said, well, how about 49-51? And I said, okay, if I have to. But I think that really set the tone. And I think, you know, it's not enough to have just women as news journalists. They have to be doing meaty reporting. You know, I covered the Pentagon, and that, I think, was really critical for me professionally, because I think after you've earned those stripes, people take you seriously. Mm-hmm. And I think when I came into the Today Show, Bryant respected me because, obviously, I knew what I was doing, having covered the Pentagon.
What do you see as the role of the evening news in the next 5 years?
Well, I think the reports of its death are greatly exaggerated, to paraphrase Mark Twain. I think that, you know, the audience is declining and it is getting older. I thought the average age of the evening news viewer was 54, and I learned today it was actually 60. And
still seems pretty young to me.
And yeah, very young. But obviously we'd like to get, you know, have a bigger spectrum of viewers in terms of age. So I think that I know that the viewership is declining slightly, but I still think it's an extremely critical agenda setting platform for every network. And I think because there's such a proliferation of information, such a cacophony of information that assaults us on a daily basis, the evening news has an opportunity to really sort of synthesize it for people and put stories in context, and also to be accurate. And, you know, because one of the things about the Internet is sometimes you don't know about its accuracy, where it's coming from in terms of blogs and other sources. So I think it still has a really, really important role in terms of the way people are getting their news. And obviously it's going to have to be shown on a variety of distribution systems, whether it's the Internet or aggregate ratings showing on cable operations and repeating so people can see it. But with TiVo and other technological advances, hopefully if they can't be there to watch it live, they can watch it when they get home.
Well, that's a good point, Bob, because in this new age of technology, we all get different pieces of news from different angles, different opinions from different angles. And it would seem to me that the one thing you've tried to do and what you're handing off to Katie, and to be blunt about it, it meant really changing a bit what CBS was about, to say this is absolute scrupulous credibility. That's the one thing you can get here that you can't get on the net or anything else.
Well, I think that's the thing that the mainstream media, not just the three networks, but also the major newspapers in the country, it's not an original thought with me, but we're getting so much news now. We're overwhelmed with information from all sides that I think somewhere in the middle, there has to be this one place where if people don't agree on the solutions to the problems, they can agree these are the problems and these are the facts. And I think that is the role of the mainstream media, just not the three evening news programs. They still attract, when you put the three of them together, what, 35 million people, which is a large number of people. The great challenge, I mean, we're in the midst of a communications revolution. The whole landscape is changing. Some people think there won't be any newspapers 5 years from now. Will all the news be downloaded onto your iPod? Nobody really knows where we're going to get our news 5 or even certainly 10 years from now. But we do know there's always going to be a need for accurate information. I think what the evening news programs have to do is find ways to tell people the vital and accurate information that they need to know to make decisions that any good citizen needs to make. We can't go on at 6:30 in the evening and do the same minute and a half piece from the White House that you've seen on cable or you've read about on the Internet all day. You've got to take it to a step beyond that. You've got to tell people something that they didn't find out earlier in the day. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to have a Watergate-style scoop every day, but you're going to add some context. Perhaps you can add some analysis. But basically, you're going to be there in the middle saying, look, you may not think this is the right way to do it, but we're going to tell you what the problem is, and we're going to tell you what various people think are the solutions to that problem. I think that is the mission of the evening news and the mainstream media in general.
You know, everything from our technology to our politics, to our media and press, these days seems to be more pulling us apart rather than bringing us together, balkanizing us rather than forming a consensus, something we deal with a bit here at the Institute. And would it seem to be your role, either of you, that to coin a phrase that, or to use a phrase that was coined by your network, to say that's the way it is? This is what we can all at least agree upon at the water cooler the next day.
Well, I think that we have agreed. I'm very dismayed at the intense polarization of the country, and I was very heartened to see that the survey that the Aspen Institute...
The Doug Schoen poll.
Yeah, that the poll actually bears that out. A lot of people are dismayed with how divided we are. And I think, quite frankly, cable news shows, which try to get the extreme view on each side and where most of the time is spent with the two guests yelling at each other, screaming, so you can't even understand either position, mm-hmm. and you feel very unsatisfied by the time it's over. I hope that we'll be able to show some very sort of well thought out, intelligent viewpoints, whether or not we show each view every night, but give people an opportunity to understand at least where the other side is coming from, because I think a lot of the entrenched viewpoints are quite frankly based on ignorance and certain attitudes where people are very narrow-minded. So I hope that we'll be able to reach out, and even if you don't agree with that particular position, at least perhaps you'll better understand it. So I'd like to elevate the level of civil discourse and make it more civil, if that's at all possible.
I think that's absolutely right. I think it goes, though, just beyond cable show screaming. I think there's several things that have led to the partisanship, the raw partisanship we now have in our public discourse. And that's not to say this is the first time it's ever been this way. It was probably nastier and even more partisan in those days during the writing of the Constitution, and they still wound up with a pretty good document. But certainly it's rawer and nastier now than it has been in any time in my professional life. Some of it, I think, is the proliferation now of opinion kind of television and radio. We're not into broadcasting much anymore. It's now narrowcasting. But I think there are other factors as well that go into this. For example, the coming of the Internet. People now tend, and I'm sure Katie's mail will, she'll say the same thing, people now tend to write me nastier letters than they ever did before. And I think one of the reasons for that is in the days of the typewriter and when we wrote with a pen, you'd sometimes sort of get it out of your system by writing that letter to the editor, and then once done, you wadded it up and threw it in the wastebasket. Now you just press that old send button, and so we get it, we get it direct and unadulterated. So I think this ability that people have to just make these direct charges, I think some civility has been lost, and I think that's one part of it. I think a lot of it, though, goes back to our politics and how nasty it has become, and that is sort of slopped over into other areas.
But I also think, in a strange way, the proliferation of news and information outlets, to be heard above the din these days,
yes,
you have to be exceedingly provocative and sometimes very personal and vicious in your position and your attacks in order to get attention, because often the more sort of reasonable or reasoned viewpoint is people pay no attention to it because it's quote-unquote boring. So I think that's part of the problem, too.
You know, one antidote to that problem would be people who are nice and authentic. And if you had to pick the two adjectives for both of you, I mean, that you really share, that you're both nice and it comes through, and you're authentic, you're normal people, it comes through. Is that something, Katie, that you, when you envision the CBS Evening News, that you're actually going to make that part of the, your mission?
Yeah, I thought my sign-off could be, I'm Katie, and I'm nice and authentic.
Yeah, right. Good.
You know what? The one thing, I mean, I think that's a thank you very much for the compliment, and I know Bob, I'm sure, is flattered as well. I think that The vision I have for the news is to sort of bit to build on what Bob has already created. I think part of the problem with the evening newscasts, at least from my perspective, is they're full of newsack, I call it. It sort of feels as if the reporting has gotten so it's slightly formulaic, and there's a certain style. in delivering where I don't necessarily feel as if people are talking directly to the viewer.
Right.
It's more sort of a script, and today on Capitol Hill, you know, you can almost sort of predict it. And I think there's a way to talk more directly to people in a more conversational style. And I think what Bob has done, and I know Les Moonves, our big honcho, Grand Fromage at CBS, talked about the voice of God phenomenon and trying to not be such an authority, because there are so many things that are so complicated in this world. And I think Bob's taken the approach, and I did on the Today Show, and hopefully will continue, where, you know, this is a very complicated world. It's a complicated subject, and I'm sort of figuring it out along with the viewers. I'm not sort of imparting my wisdom on them, and I think that's really important. And I also think, I said this at the affiliates meeting not too long ago, that I think sometimes journalists get caught up in presenting a story more for politicians or competitors and not necessarily for the American people. And sometimes stories really need to be put in context. And I don't think people have such busy lives. They're not necessarily following every step of what's happened with the kidnapping in the Gaza Strip. They need to know sort of what happened 2 days ago and how we got to this position. Or, you know, Walter Cronkite did a whole flow chart after Watergate, and I often thought with the whole Valerie Plame story, I could hardly follow what was going on with Robert Novak and all the different reporters who were involved in the controversy. And I never felt like that was very well explained on television, and more importantly, why it should matter to the American people. I think it becomes somewhat insular in the journalistic community, whether it's print, internet, or television, and sometimes we forget who our audience is.
Yeah. CBS,
let me just
go ahead, Bob.
Add on. Sure. You know, since you mentioned my Walter Cronkite was kind of my role model, and that's who I wanted to be when I grew up. And I think the two great secrets to Walter's success: Walter never left the impression that he knew more about something or that he was smarter than everybody else. He left the impression that he was curious and that he had done his homework. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, is the best way to deliver the news. And Walter, I would say, was the single most curious person I have ever met. He always had a question, and that's why he was such a great editor. He could always think of the question that you would forget to ask. And he was famous for asking these questions at 6:20, questions like, how much oil is in the world? Well, who the hell knows how much oil there is in the world?
Actually, half this room probably.
Yeah. Unfortunately, yeah. You know, or my favorite from Walter was, how long is Greenland? Beats me. But Walter would always think of those questions. The other part about Walter that I think had a great deal to do with his success, he was exactly off camera as he was on camera. He really did talk.
Which is the same with the two of you all, too. Bravo.
He's a great man.
CBS had a bad reputation of being far too liberal. I've known you all for a long time. I don't know your politics at all. But what do you think of the liberal charge for the mainstream media, or how it affects you all as journalists?
Go ahead. I learned a couple of things here, didn't I, along the way.
You know, well, certainly that charge has existed about journalists for many, many years. And I think that, you know, I know that I've tried my best through my career to ask challenging questions to whomever I'm speaking. And whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, I try to raise important issues depending on their particular position. And I think I'll continue to do that. I think that oftentimes you're a Rorschach, that wrong? Is that Rorschach test or whatever? And oftentimes people they see you from their own individual prisms. And if you're not reflecting their point of view, or you're asking an antagonistic question of someone they might agree with in terms of policy, they see you as the enemy. And I think that's just a mistake. I think my job is to politely but persistently ask challenging questions. And you know, it took me a few years on the Today Show to get the self-confidence to say to a senator or someone in a high-ranking position, I'm sorry, Senator, but you didn't answer my question. And I really just see that as my job. And in certain cases, it'll be offensive to various viewers, but You just can't let it bother you. You just have to forge ahead.
You know what I think, Walter? I think the press is like a draft army. It generally reflects the society that it comes from. And in a draft army, you have people from all walks of life, and they have all different kinds of points of view. And I think it's the same thing in the press. But I think that I would say 95% of the reporters I know are really just hardworking people who are trying to get the story, and I think that's what motivates them, get the story and get it on the air or in their newspaper before their competitor does. And I know some reporters who have very hard right views and some who have hard left views, but I think as trained journalists, you can put that aside. It is much more difficult, I think, to be objective than it is to be fair. But I think there is a way to be fair, and I think if you let the other guy have his say when you're doing a story about a controversial issue, I think then you're fulfilling your obligation. But let me also say this. The greatest defense against charges of bias is accuracy. Yeah. If you get the story right, there's not much that anybody can say or criticize you for getting it.
So. But I'll give a counterexample. Would you have printed the Swift story, the terrorism story, which was accurate, right? And I'm not sure I would not have printed it if I had been the editor.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. And I had Bill Keller of the New York Times, who was my guest on Face the Nation Sunday. It was fascinating. Bill says that he believes that the terrorists, you'd have to be a pretty dumb terrorist not to know that that's what we were doing.
Now, we got dumb terrorists
and,
in this world.
Well, there may be some. And that was basically his justification, because I asked him, I said, why did you decide to publish this story? Why did you think it was in the public interest to know? And his answer was, we think the public needs to know what the government is doing, not always just because it's illegal. He did not allege in the story that the practice was illegal. I'm going to take a pass on that. I think it was right to publish the eavesdropping stories. Yeah. I think that there was reason enough to publish that. On this one, I do not know enough about this to make a judgment on whether I would have not, but I certainly would have given a lot of thought before I did. And to the Times' credit, they did give it a lot of thought. They didn't just wake up in the middle of the night and say, let's do this.
And we should mention, the L.A. Times and the Wall Street Journal also published it, so the New York Times gets the brunt of the blame, but certainly other publications followed suit.
But you better watch it. It's like CBS News in a way. The L.A. Times, New York Times, and Wall Street Journal does it. But the Times will get the blame, and in some ways it happens where CBS sometimes was the focus.
What do they say? Everybody hates the Yankees.
Yeah, right. Except for you. You don't like the Yankees. And let's go. Yes, Dan Glickman, is that right? Or I can't call everybody by name because they put lights on me.
You both made an excellent point that I'd just like to reinforce, the importance of making the news understandable for people outside of Washington, D.C. There's this disaffection out there where people don't think what happens in Washington perhaps is as important as they should be, and there's this horrendous lack of civics education in the country where people don't know anything about their government, which is very harmful to a democracy. And you still, the three networks, still have the power to get that information to people so they know that what their government does is important to them. And I would just urge you to continue to do that and think about that.
Thank you. Further comments, questions? Yes. And as I say, I can't recognize you, so stand up, grab a mic. Yeah.
My name is Fleur Strand, and I was just wondering if you ever watched the PBS show, The News, with Jim Lehrer, because I think he does a lot of the things that you are planning to do. He interviews people, he asks difficult questions, but not antagonistic, and when he has a panel, he has people with different points of view, and they never shout at each other.
Well, I watch him because even a person my age needs an older role model.
Yay!
Jim is a great friend of mine, and he is a terrific journalist. And I think he has an hour. He has time to explore various subjects. And yes, indeed, I do watch the Lehrer News Hour.
And I envy the fact that he does have an hour, because I think it does provide you with a lot more time to explore some issues in depth. I think I wish the CBS Evening News could be an hour, and when I approached the executives, they pretty much laughed in my face. When I, you know, I think the world might be okay without the insider personally, but I'm not sure everyone agrees with me.
Shashi Tharoor back there, I see.
Yes, I'm Shashi Tharoor of the United Nations. I was wondering whether you might at all be tempted to devote a little more attention on the news to the rest of the world. It's been a source of enormous frustration for many of us, how difficult it is to get Americans to think about the world, to understand what goes on. There are statistical studies that show that CBS, for example, I believe, is showing 75% less international news since 1980. And that is probably with the exception of Iraq, but then apart from Iraq, what else do Americans hear about when it comes to the rest of the world? I'm struck by a European friend who came and watched World News Tonight and couldn't find a single item of world news on it. So would you try and remedy that for the rest of us and help America understand the world it's so important that Americans understand?
I think you make an excellent point. I think it was really back in the 90s when there was a lot of cost-cutting at the networks that foreign bureaus started to be shut down. And I think particularly now with all the things that we've been hearing about at the Institute, you know, for the last couple of days and will in the next few days with globalization and sort of being part of a world economy and certainly Iraq, that there is a need for international news. But again, I think that a lot of this is how it's presented and how it's done and making it accessible and understandable. I think if you ask most people why the situation's going on as it is in Darfur, they would not be able to answer. It's extremely complex. It's difficult to do in a 22-minute newscast, but certainly we're going to try to do that. And I think it is a balance, but I think you're right. I think the you know, it's always the chicken or the egg. If you give people more international news, will they want it? In other words, is that part of our responsibility? And I do think it is.
Let me just add on to that. I'm not sure I would agree with it 75% less. You may be right, but even if you are, there is one of the reasons that this happened. I'm not saying it's right, but one of the reasons that it happened, and there's a historical cycle here. Generally, in times when the United States, because it's protected by an ocean on each side, generally in its history, when it has felt a threat from across one of those oceans, the interest of the American people has been increased toward more foreign news coverage. Once the Soviet Union collapsed and people no longer saw that as a threat, the American people, as they generally do, turned inward. And when they did, the news media turned inward with them. I'm not saying we did the right thing. We probably did the wrong thing. But that's one of the reasons we got to where we are. Now, I would also add, and I take a little pride in this, we are now doing considerably more news on the CBS Evening News, overseas news and foreign news, than we were when I came there. And one of the reasons for that is we have discovered this remarkable young reporter named Laura Logan, mm-hmm. who is the bravest and one of the smartest people I know who has gone out and found this news. So sometimes it depends on who you have working for you that determines how much foreign news you put on the air. But that's sort of the historical context about how this came about. I agree with you in the abstract. Yes, we ought to do more foreign news.
Yeah, there's a hand there. I'm trying to be fair here to get both sides of the room, but it's very hard for me to see. Oh, it's Sydney Harmon. Is that right?
No.
No, no, sorry. Sorry.
But I might like to be.
I'm not going to go there.
In the past few days, I've heard the word fairness and objective used by many people in many different ways. I wonder if you would tell me what your interpretation, each of you, of fairness and objective means, not the dictionary interpretation of it, or the dictionary spelling of it. I'd like to know how you interpret it.
Well, for me, it's obviously asking pointed, challenging questions that may make the person more obligated to defend his or her point of view. To me, that's fair, but also to give the person time to express himself or herself. That to me, I think, and to be polite and, as I said earlier, persistent I think one of the problems with the news these days, though, is that oftentimes what journalists consider fair or what they may feel is fair is really kind of abdicating their responsibility. I think the New York Times, I think the New York Review of Books talked about this a few months ago as well, but that there's so much pressure, I think, because the country is so polarized and you can't alienate 50% of the viewing audience to show both sides or to show two different perspectives. And it ends up really being two different spins. But our job is really to find the truth and to discover what is actually the facts of the story. So I think that I hope we do more of that. And to me, that is really the ultimate example of fairness and objectivity, to actually find facts and not necessarily spin or point of view. And obviously, facts are in the eyes sometimes of the beholder. Having said that, some, you know, what Walter and I were talking about, the Daniel Patrick Moynihan quote, where everyone's entitled to his own opinion, but no one is entitled to his own facts. So I think that we have to do a better job of finding the real truth of the story and not just show two different sides of the story or two different spins and as a result feel that we've done our jobs.
I think it comes down to getting as close to you as you can to the truth. And that means talking to people on all sides of an issue and then coming to some conclusion of what you think the truth is. Objectivity does not necessarily mean doing a story that says on the one hand and on the other hand. I mean, would it be objective to say on the one hand Hitler was a pretty bad guy, but on the other hand he did a lot for the German economy? No. The objective view of Hitler is that he was a monster, and there's no other way to put that. I think the journalist's role is to remember that the politicians are there to deliver a message. Your job is to get as close to you as you can to the truth, and I think it comes down to no more than that.
Well, in the back, the Roosevelt Institute guy, I think, right? Either somebody wearing his hat, one or the other.
It's kind of a mini drudge.
Yeah.
Hold it closer. All right. Quick question about local media, which is often a punchline in today's world. It's even a couple of movies. Will Ferrell did a movie about local media. And I'm curious what, Katie, you see your role in both bringing local stories to national light that have so much effect on our lives, especially in politics that takes such place at the local level, and also in supporting local media out in our neck of the woods.
Well, I think nationalizing local stories, or, you know, every story is a local story in a way, and I think that part of our mission is to show the national implications or the national ramifications of a particular story. And I think that we'll be working very closely, and I'm sure Bob already does, and the whole CBS News team with local stations to bring important local stories to light. And obviously all big stories and trends start at a local level. So, you know, they're extremely important partnerships to us. And I always thought that there should be a closer and a more sort of dynamic relationship between local news operations and the national news as well.
Let me ask you sort of a related question, which is good cause stories. You and I first worked together professionally, I think, when you were involved with the colon cancer cause because of your husband's death, and you were going to be on Time magazine because we wanted to do personalized colon cancer. Do you think that's your role of a good... I mean, I do. I mean, why we put you on the cover, but do you think that's part of a role of a journalist and a public figure to be involved with certain good causes like that that can help people's lives?
Well, I think advocacy journalism, I think it depends on what you're advocating and what particular cause you're espousing. When my husband died of colon cancer, I knew there was such a tremendous informational vacuum that existed. And I also knew that I had this incredible bully pulpit and forum that I could actually talk to people about all the things that I learned during the course of Jay's illness. And I felt, quite frankly, that it would be downright criminal not to take advantage of that bully pulpit. Sometimes I feel guilty, like a colon cancer pig, like I only want to talk about colon cancer because there are so many important causes. There's so many medical ailments that deserve a lot of attention, and I certainly try to do that as well. And I'm very interested, I think, because I had to become sort of an instant oncologist during the course of this illness. I'm extremely interested in medical news and imparting medical information, because I think it's like learning an entire new language when you're thrust into this world of cancer or any other terrible life-threatening disease. So I think I'm proudest of my colon cancer work, and you know, the notion that I've been able to help save some lives or increase awareness, and that people are walking around because they either watched my colonoscopy, which, you know, was, hi, how you doing, you know, up close and personal, and or you know, I got a lovely letter from a very celebrated architect, after, and he said he had read the story on Time magazine. He went and got a colonoscopy, and it saved his life. To be able to have that kind of impact on the world, I think, is just a...
The architect now working on the World Trade Center. Right?
Yeah, it's really a wonderful thing. On the other hand, I have people sending me slides of their colonoscopies and all sorts of details about their rectal bleeding that, quite frankly, I could do without. I'm always like, thanks for sharing. But I really feel that I was able to utilize my position and spare some families the pain and anguish that mine had to experience.
Oh, Evelyn Lauder, so that'll follow up nicely.
I just want to make a comment about what Katie said. In the medical community, she's so well known for what is now known as the Couric effect. Because of what she did with colon cancer several years ago, having her own colonoscopy publicly viewed on her show, and then last year when she took a mammography, she saved thousands of lives because thousands of people went to take all those tests. So I really applaud you.
And applaud Evelyn Lauder, too, has done so much. Yes, sir, right there with your hand up.
By the way, my first show on the CBS Evening News, I'm getting a pap smear.
Oh.
That'll get the ratings up.
Hard act to follow.
Sorry you're having to follow that.
Can you identify yourself too?
I am Cooper Henderson. I am a Bezos scholar. I am from Moab, Utah, and I am 17 years old.
Wait, before you go on, let me explain. The Bezos scholars are Mike and Jackie Bezos. Every year, we have two types of scholars that come here. Some, because we want a good diversity in this room of activists and communities, people do things, but also young people. And if there are other Bezos scholars, may I ask the Bezos scholars to stand, please? Thank you. That's an easier act to follow than a pap smear, so go ahead.
Thank you. Like I said, I'm 17 years old. A vast majority of my peers do not watch the news, and the level of disconnection they have with the world around them is frightening. The voter turnout between ages 18 and 25 is just honestly disgusting. I want to know what in the major news in America you can do to help increase the participation of youth across the world in the local, state, and federal communities all around them to really try to help things out.
Well, I think that's... I'm just going to say quickly, I think that's such a huge challenge and such an important one. And, you know, sometimes I wonder if that train has left the station. I have a 14-year-old who gets all her news, and I don't even think she pays that much attention to the news, but she downloads all her songs and watches Sex and the City on her computer. And I think that we have to have a lot of what's called in the business convergence now, where we're not just showing up in one outlet, where we have a strong internet presence, where we do stories that people like you care about, where we try to make possibly watching the evening news a family activity again, as it was in Walter Cronkite's days. I mean, I think families are so torn apart. The idea that so many families don't eat dinner together because of our hectic lives, I know that's something I always try to do with my daughters, but I think that we're going to just have to really try as hard as we can to engage young people like you and hear from you and find out from you what you care about, what issues you care about, and what people your age are talking about. I know Nancy Gibbs is working on a story for Time on 16-year-olds and what is on their
Both
minds.
Both of you and Newsweek should not now try to take that cover away from Time.
Sorry. Yeah. And, you know, and so I think that we have to do a very concerted outreach program to get people more engaged in the process, and it's certainly going to be one of our biggest goals.
Well, I think everything Katie says is absolutely correct. But, you know, I think some of it comes back to you. And my observation in working with young people and the interns that come work on Face the Nation is the smart ones figure it out and the dumb ones don't. And I think sometimes figuring out all this is going to come from within. And I think you've got a great generation. You have access to more information than mine ever did. And I think the smart ones will figure it out, and I think they'll find a need for accurate information. I don't know if they're going to get it on television. I don't know if they're going to get it on iPods, but I think that I think it may not be as bad as you think it is. I think the bright people in your generation will figure this out. They'll figure it out because they have to.
And there's some, I agree with Bob, there's some personal responsibility involved in this. As well, you know, it's not necessarily completely our job to entice your generation into caring about the world around you. I mean, obviously, I think we can do a better job, but I think you all have to meet us halfway or at least a quarter of the way.
Yeah, it's important to remember, we're not in charge of events. We're in charge of reporting the events. It's our job to present the information. It's the citizen's job to decide what needs to be done with it.
But don't you think technology will offer you better ways to present it so that different generations will also consume it?
Well, I think it's going to have to.
Well, it already has. I mean, as I say, we have access to more information than any people that have ever lived on the earth at any one point in time. The great problem now is figuring out how to sort it all out.
Right.
That's
how
the job of
it.
The CBS Evening News.
That's what our job is supposed to be. But then there has to be some reaction to it,
yeah.
You know.
Yes.
We may all have to settle in here.
Yeah, well, tell me when the rain slows down a bit. We have about 5 more minutes, but we will, if it's storming, we'll just keep talking and we'll bring up others.
My name is Pamela Zucker. I've been struck by the discussion of the polarization of America, and Larry Summers has said the truth is in the middle, in the center. But I'm also struck by the fact that in media, those of us who consume media who are in the center don't really understand the passions of the people on either end of the continuum. And I don't think that gets presented to us in a way that we can integrate it and understand and maybe get passionate enough ourselves to get as involved as they are.
Yeah, let me add to that, which is I'm not sure we've become more polarized. I think the polls have become more passionate, and that's now distorting the way we do news and politics. Is that possible, too?
Oh,
what do you do about it?
That's a very interesting point. I went to a graduate seminar down at George Washington University not so long ago, and we were talking about news presented from a partisan point of view, and one of the graduates made a very interesting point to me. She said, I really kind of prefer to get the news from someone who speaks from a point of view, because I believe that if they have come to the point where they have a point of view on something, then they really care about the news. And she said, you guys in the middle, she said, I get the feeling that you really don't care enough to take a point of view on it. And I think that's one of the things that those of us in mainstream journalism have to deal with. I mean, we have to somehow or another convince people that, look, we may have a point of view. That, in a funny way, is beside the point. What we're trying to do is present the information to you, and we care deeply about getting it right and getting the right information to you. But I think it is something in today's world that we all have to deal with.
Well, especially if you have Fox, which espouses a particular point of view, or Lou Dobbs, who's very vocal and vociferous about the immigration issue and has taken a very strong position. And a lot of people in the mainstream media feel fairly uncomfortable with that. And so, it's a bit of a conundrum, because some people want to watch, as I said earlier, people who are reflecting their own points of view, they get all jazzed, and it galvanizes the core audience. And
but suppose Sean McManus or Les Moonves came to either of you all, said, Bob, Face the Nation could double its ratings if you became more of an advocate, if you became more like Lou Dobbs or whatever it may be, or said that to you. How would you push back?
Well, I mean, he would have to get someone else. I mean, that just sort of isn't my style. And maybe there's somebody out there, and I wouldn't be surprised if you couldn't find somebody who had a very strong point of view that could raise the ratings. Because if you can capture a certain, the majority of a certain demographic, you can rise to the top in anything. And I just refer you to the New York Times bestseller list and some of the books that reach the top. I don't think that those books always reflect the views of most people in the country, but they reflect the view of enough people in that particular demographic that it's enough to sell enough books to get to the top. So you might could raise the ratings on a program. But, I mean, I wouldn't. It just wouldn't be something that would be of interest to me.
Back there, and then up here will be the last two questions. Yes. Susan, all right.
I'm Susan Skog. I'm a writer and an author. Many people are saying right now that so many people may be tuning out of both print and broadcast media because the audience is hungry for hopeful stories. They know they can always get something negative. They know that there's an easy access to negative spot news, but that many people, including young people, are hungry to see progress. They're hungry to hear of hopeful stories happening in the grassroots. They're hungry to hear about humanitarian issues. What room is there within evening news for that? And might that also attract more of the viewers that you hope to see if you show some of those humanitarian or compassion in action stories?
Let's start with Katie on that one.
Well, I think it's always a balance. Obviously, you can't be necessarily Pollyanna-ish and see the world through rose-colored glasses and be completely solution-oriented when something horrific or heinous is happening somewhere in the world and people need to know about it. On the other hand, I think you're right. I think that America is an optimistic country, and I think that the news can be more solution-oriented and talk about some of the positive things. I have a cousin in Alabama, and he called me and said, Katie, how come y'all never talk about some of the good things that are going on in Iraq? Well, that's a very complicated issue with security and trying to get out to tell some of the good stories, but I think you're right. I think we can do some more hopeful, uplifting, positive things because I think there are so many great things that are not only happening in this country but all around the world that are worthy of attention, and that sometimes you do get a jaundiced view of the world because there is so many bad things happening as well. So I think it's all a question of balance.
Right up here in the front.
I'm Janice Starznick from Reading, Pennsylvania. This is directed to both of you. Considering the time constraint of 22 minutes and also ratings pressures, how do you walk that tightrope between being entertaining and actually presenting information? And also, how much input do you have as anchors in making the decision on what is presented?
You want me to go first?
Yeah. Sure.
Well, I'll just tell you the deal that I have, that the executive producer and I decide what's going to go on the evening news. And if one of us does not want to put it on there, then it doesn't get on there. So you could say we have total control. I mean, that's basically how we do it at CBS. I go to work at 9 o'clock every morning, and I work until 7 o'clock when we get the news over with. And I participate in all the major decisions. I don't, spend a lot of time correcting the grammar, and we do have some of that needs to be done and that sort of thing, but I take a very active role, and I just don't think you can do it. Other people may want to do it a different way, but I just don't think you can. That's my way, and that's what's always worked for me.
And you're already trying to generate story ideas. I mean, that's what you're doing in your month or two wandering.
Yeah,
and the American dream, immigration, everything.
Well, yeah. I have a lot of input as well. I mean, I wouldn't have accepted this job if I didn't have a voice in what we were going to cover and how we were going to cover it, and I didn't have certain ideas and a vision, you know. One of the frustrating things about the Today Show, which was really a very positive experience for me, but sometimes I would suggest stories that I thought, I think in retrospect, were maybe too in-depth and substantive for the morning. And I think that there's plenty of entertainment stuff on television. I mean, I just feel like, God, I don't know why these people are so interested in all this celebrity stuff for hours on end. So I think that's taken care of. But I do think that, you know, but I do think it, you know, we're a visual medium and we have to be, we have to present important stories in an entertaining way, or at least an engaging and compelling way. You know, and I think there's no crime in doing that, and that's part of our responsibility, because we have to get people's attention. You know, they're doing a lot of different things when they're certainly in the morning, and even in the evening I was thinking about how busy everyone is, and people are probably rushing around getting their kids dinner, and maybe it's on in the background. I don't know if there are many people other than my mom and dad who are going to be sitting there, you know, completely transfixed by every word I'm saying. So, you know, I think that we have to do things in an entertaining way, but pure entertainment, I think, is not something I'm particularly interested in.
Before we end this, can I just say how happy I am that Katie Couric is coming to CBS.
Society.
Well, I have known Katie for a long, long time, and we have been friends. I mean, does she have the professional qualifications? That goes without saying. Of course she does. And she's going to bring all of that. But in addition to that, she is a wonderful person who knows who she is, and that's going to transmit. I think that's what's going to happen. And she did attract a little attention getting this job. You may have noticed in the papers. They did write several stories about it. I think this is going to raise the ratings of all three network news programs, because it's going to remind a lot of people who may have forgotten that there are news programs that come on ABC and NBC and CBS is 6:30. Now, I'm hoping that our ratings are the ones that are going to wind up on top. But you heard it here first. I think the ratings of all three broadcasts will go up, and I'm just delighted that Katie Couric is going to be the one that joins the team that we kind of have put together over the last year and a half. She's going to be perfect.
Bravo. Thank you all very much.
Thanks,
really wonderful. And you can stay here in the rain and can continue talking. Thank you.
That was good. That was fun.